Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
QNL.
So you don't try to kill each other?
No.
No, not in the game. I mean, on the show, obviously we do.
A composite show, archive segments from previous episodes that got cut due to time.
From episode 124.
One of our audience members, T.W. Squeaks, had a Civ 4 related question for us. Any tips on what to read or how to be proactive in warfare in Civ 4? I feel like I've got a good handle on peacetime strategies, but war is definitely the weak side of my games, unquote. So a little bit of dip here to Civ 4.
Wow, that's a little on the general side. I guess when you're going to be planning a war in Civ 4, it's not different from Civ 5. You want to make sure you have enough units and you can actually win. And there's a number of ways to go about that. Usually, if you're on difficulties like Monarch and below, Power Graph is not too bad of an indicator. On high difficulties, it gets a little more complicated because AI has such bonuses that they can spam out units, and they'll have tons of units in every city, but a lot of them are locked in each individual city, or not part of the AI's offensive stack. So you can wind up declaring on an AI that has, like, double your power, or, you know, 50% more power than you, and still killing it. So how do you know? Well, one way is you can send a unit through their cities with open borders, or, you know, maybe later game, use an air unit to do air recon and just see where their units are and how many. And that can certainly let you get an idea of how much you need to kill them. And other than that, just make sure you have enough units and you either have a tech lead or you have a stack composition that allows you to not take too much attrition. So, if you're going like rifles against longbows and you have spies dropping the city defenses, or maybe just cavalry and spies, or cannons plus anything, as long as you can keep the cannons alive, that stuff's all good. And just make sure you don't get swarmed by the AI's primary offensive stack. If you do that, you can usually outproduce it and start taking cities. And then you just have to plan out, okay, how many cities I'm going to take, how much garrison I'm going to leave behind, whatever, and throw in some extra for random, I lose at 98% odd stuff, which does happen. That gets a lot less problematic once you involve siege, though. My only other tip for warfare is when you start building up for warfare, go all out on it. Don't make it take forever, because if you do, the AI will catch up in tech, it'll start upgrading its units, whatever. And if you, the faster you hit, and the harder you hit once you declare, as in the shorter the war lasts, the less chances the other AI have of screwing you, and the less chances your target as of upgrading its units or doing something that can become problematic for you, like peace vassaling to someone else or whatever. So, or actually I say permanent alliance vassal, because that mechanic is cheap and stupid, just like all capitulation mechanics in Civ 4. So I don't know, hopefully that answers your question. I don't know how beyond that. A lot of it's just a question of experience too.
Yeah, you may need to have a series of wars as well. Kind of getting what Phil was saying, that, you know, don't let it go on too long. You may find yourself in a situation where it's, okay, well, I've taken some frontline cities, and maybe I've done some pillaging here, but now I need to heal, I need to let the city become under my control, I need to get my war weariness down a little bit, and maybe the AI can actually give me something in a peace treaty that would help me with that. Maybe it's some gold, maybe it's a resource, maybe it's just even a ceasefire. Maybe you just need a half dozen turns where you know there isn't going to be a countermeasure to something that's really injured to get some more troops to the front, et cetera, et cetera. So it's, it really does come down to experience, and it's a lot of individual circumstance is based. And, if you're tired of peacetime, you can play Always War. Okay, that was a little non sequitur, but I felt the need to say.
Always War is nonsense. It'd be different if everyone were at war with everyone, but that's not how it goes. No, everyone's just at war with you.
Hello, Edward.
Hello.
Did you want to say what your username is or not?
Well, my handle is Civ Battle.
And you told me that you agreed with Magin that Deity is easier now, but then Civ 5 is easier than Civ 4.
Yeah, because you don't have a lot of choices in Civ 5. compared to Civ 4.
Yeah.
There's well, some changes. The AI is worse at, well, it's worse at Warfare because of the game mechanics. It has less ability to use its bonuses to kill you at war than it had in Civ 4. Because in Civ 4, I don't care how badly the AI plays, if it hits you with like 100 units or something or more, it's going to hurt. And there's a good chance you're going to die to that if it hits you with 100 units soon enough or they're advanced enough. But in Civ 5, even if you have an inferior army, if you have a lot of experience on your units or you fight with decent, you know, tactical sense, you can just mow down droves of enemy troops and keep your cities alive and viable. So that's a big difference between just there. The ability for the AI leverage bonuses to kill you just doesn't exist in Civ 5. And yeah, as Edward points out, the options are reduced. Although I would say that I'm probably still better in Civ 4 than Civ 5 because I've played Civ 4 more. But I would still say that Civ 5 is probably a little bit easier at the high levels.
Yeah, but you have to think Civ 4 vanilla versus Civ 5 vanilla, because, you know.
Oh, that's even worse. Civ 4 vanilla is ridiculous. The bonuses it's were broken. Obscene. Yeah. Someone has discovered liberalism. It's like 300 BC. Come on now.
Yeah. No, I'm talking options, not how hard it was. I remember Civ 4 vanilla. It was annoying. There are options out there. I mean, and realistically, I don't blame the AI for sucking at combat. I blame 2K and Firaxis for wasting 4 years pissing around with stuff and then deciding to put a game together. They had the time, they had the money, they could have took the time to do it knowing that this change was coming, and they didn't.
Yeah.
And we got what we got. So it's not that they could not have made a tactical AI that worked within the system. That's not hard. It's actually fairly straightforward. It takes time, it takes some effort, it takes some balancing, but they could have done it. At least one that wasn't completely idiotic that would send its settler spamming at you in the middle of a fight, or its great engineer spamming at you in the middle of a fight, and at least kept the range behind the melee units and did proper tactics that way. That is easily possible. All they have to do is watch a few people play the game just to see what the humans would do and say, okay, do that.
Yeah, pretty much. Still reminded, because I'm LPing it right now, a game from the 90s, Heroes of Might and Magic 3, that had a lot of tactical fighting in it, and it's the AI could really surprise you and screw you sometimes, just by hitting you with certain spells or doing things in certain orders, and it did tend to do the best thing on average, and I think that is a result of the stuff they saw from the humans in that tactical, in its tactical combat. Now, it's not perfect, and neither would Civ 5's, but I certainly agree with you. They could have made Civ 5's tactical AI so much stronger, because it does throw units away and do some really questionable things.
Yeah, there's things it could have done that they could have taken the time to do, but they chose not to. And it's just due to, I know I keep harping on this, but it's bad management. Not necessarily bad design, but bad management.
Episode 119.
Accept friendship offer from remote civilization. From East Kitten. Ooh, I wonder if there's a West Kitten. But, or any other directional kitten. Anyway, he says, recently early in the game, when I've met a few bordering civs, a new civ sails by and shortly afterwards suggests a declaration of friendship. I have no idea where they are on the huge map. Should I accept? What are the considerations? And Imagine had a reply in that thread as well, and I'll quote him, paraphrasing slightly, that generally it really depends on how the other AIs view them. If they're already a pariah, then friending them might not help you. I've certainly seen accepting friendship requests going partially the other way, where another civ goes, oh, I see that you've become friends with so-and-so. So have we. Perhaps this is the start of a makeshift alliance. Not that that concept of a makeshift alliance I've ever found ever comes about ever, but it certainly can be a positive diplomatic modifier that, you know, oh, we are friends with the same civs. But you could also get that converse. So if for your own self-protection you're not really concerned if X civ is upset that you are friends with this one, then I don't see a particular issue with it.
You do get a bonus merit for having a declaration of friendship with a mutual third party on top of your standard declaration of friendship merit under the hood. So that's one of the reasons in that thread. I really need to find it. And you get extra bonuses for having a third party like that, such that you want to stagger your declarations of friendship such that you don't run out with, like, both at the same time, or else they might not resign it, whereas if you stagger it, they will resign it in some cases. And this does allow you to get away with things that you normally wouldn't otherwise. So there are some reasons to sign declarations of friendship. Now, signing it with someone arbitrarily right at the start of the game certainly carries some risks. You could probably hold off on that one until you know for a fact that you're not going to be screwing yourself in doing it. But certainly, if this is remote but not hated, then declaration of friendship can be useful.
And I guess the converse also applies when if an AI says, hey, why don't we denounce this person together?
Yeah, that's usually not going to happen unless I'm plotting against them already. I don't know, why bother?
Yeah, if you declare war for any reason, you do take a hit. So you have to be careful of that. I don't like that the AI cheats to know your actions before it's met you, though. That annoys me. You know, some things didn't need to be carried over from Civ 4. That's one of them. Just didn't need to happen.
From episode 125.
So, now, next pick is by Burgled Van. This is the third stables. To maximize efficiency, the less stable, the better. One or two barracks, no stables, like archers and spears and post-count. Freeze up archers to push forward. Your thoughts? Wow, this is those weighted coins because it depends on what you're doing. If you're planning like a horse archer, you're only going to have two or three, and you're probably going to have stables in all of them because you're going to go horseback riding, archery, to build the horse, have time to build barracks, stables for the part while you're in there. And the promotion help with your survival odds a good bit, so it's worth getting. But if you're doing a horse arch, like say you're making elephants, then it's as Gold Rand said, you want as few cities as possible. Any that's building other than mounted unit with consistency probably shouldn't hit those hammers. And they are more expensive than barracks, as well, especially for cities like a grab or whatever. There's not a good answer to that. It really depends on how many cities you have, whether you're chopped extensively into a city versus another, whether you're going for all out mounting versus a mix of units, melee units, and the timing of doing this, and using elephant, cavalry. And if you're spamming out cavalry, you might want them everywhere. If you're going to go like mass rush by strategy, or if you're going to go by strategy, you can get away with only putting them in a couple cities, then your gold as your production hit rifle and upgrade. There's no clear here. You're going to have to look at it game by game basis. But yes, the first one of this is pretty much sir. Maximize efficiency, less stable is the better, with the caveat, yeah, you want enough state to produce your 5 experience mounted unit.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that whatever number of cities you have, just like with any city that you have, you don't, not necessarily want, sometimes you don't want to be putting every building you can in there. If your city is going to be producing military units, at some point and relatively quickly, you definitely have a barracks in there. And of course, for people who may not be familiar listening to this now or afterwards, you have yourself a barracks and a stable in your city, then your mounted units will not just get one, but two promotions right from the outset, or at least the ability, I should say, to get them. You don't have to choose them, like is a now a default feature in Civilization V. If you're trying to go for that early horse rush, it still says it's very situational. If you're really close together, probably one in a lot of situations would be beneficial. But that doesn't mean that every city that you're going to be producing a horse archer rush from should have it. When timing is an issue, sufficient numbers, and perhaps even also if you have a technological lead over it, you're not going to need that promotion and the time that you need to build slash perhaps even whip the stable. You could have had X number of horse archers out there to get yourself that much farther along. But I do think eventually, later on in the game, more often than not, you are going to want a stable, and at least the cities that are going to be producing your mounted units more often than not.
There is some actual literature on the forum these days. This is only done a couple months ago or a month or two ago. that will give you an idea of just how much you need to have X chance of success on a rush, like 5 unpromoted axes against 2 archers or whatever. Or, you know, maybe 5 promoted axes have slightly higher chance. You can see that. And it's worth taking a look if you really want to go perfect hammer optimization. Because a lot of the early rushes came to the conclusion that the barracks wasn't worthwhile. And the only exception to that is if you couldn't build the axes yet and you had to build something related to the rush, you might as well build the barracks. But I found it interesting that for some timings, the barracks isn't worth constructing. And I'm sure that's true for stables, too. I guess it depends on your production at that point. You know, are you going to put your hammers into the stable while teching, or do you have strong tech, low production? Maybe you just want to get started on the horse archers right away.
Okay, let's see. Attempt at a segue. None of this topic has been stabilized.
Oh, God.
Pain. Physical pain.
From episode 127.
So, regarding roads and railroads, looks like Eirok, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, has brought up a question where he is referring to how a lot of people talk about setting up trade networks, and sometimes people prefer to use harbors instead, so that they don't have to pay that gold maintenance on those connections, which can be pretty killer early in the game, when just a few gold difference can be pretty critical. So the big incentive, it seems, to build redundant roads is faster movement around for your military units, but throughout the remainder of the threads, some very well-experienced players like Dave McW are concluding that you probably don't want to build roads that aren't simply for trade routes. So that seems to be the way that the thread is going. People are referring to Civilization IV and building roads to luxuries, and it's noted that you don't really need to do that. The only reason you might want to do that in Civ V is to protect those luxuries from, say, marauding barbarians. One thing that I don't believe has been mentioned in this thread is that you often want barbarians to destroy your luxuries. Because if you are in, and this is a bit of an exploit,
I know
but
where
if
you're
you
going
are
with this.
In
yeah.
a trade agreement with an AI, and you are providing them with a luxury resource, and they gave you a lump sum of gold, then if they, the barbarians, that is, destroy that luxury resource, the trade agreement is broken, but you've already got the gold. And as soon as you kill the barbarian and repair the luxury, you've got it back. So I like that. If you really do want to defend that luxury, it probably makes more sense to have a unit on the luxury than to garrison it in the city and have the road built out to every single luxury so that you can go and defend it. So I think that part is mentioned.
Yeah.
So the other thing about roads is that you often may find yourself wanting two roads to go from one city to another. Say you have cities that are built in a giant loop, where you go way north, then you go way east, then you go way south. It might make more sense from that starting city to build another road that just goes directly east. But as has been noted, you probably don't want to do that until very later in the game when you have the money to be able to afford that trade route or that spare road.
Yeah, it's important.
So I kind of agree with that.
Yeah, you want to... okay, roads to nowhere in Civ V, unless you think you're really going to get screwed over and you're not going to be able to take back whatever it was that was taken. Short of that, I wouldn't do that. And if you've realized, gee, I'm not going to be able to get this back, I think you have greater problems than the fact that you didn't have a road to nowhere to begin with. Yes, as far as a trade route, you want to make sure that when you make the trade route, between your two cities, that you're actually going to be able to pay for the maintenance at least. I mean, yes, the roads are going to give you faster movement, but if it's hurting your economy, then wait for your city to grow. Who was it that put it in the formula here? Rex Mundi, that the formula, your city population times 1.1 plus your capital population times 0.15 minus 1 is the formula being used. So if your capital is, say, smaller than the second city that you're using to connect or whatever, you need to take that into account, and also the distance between between the two cities. It's suggested in the thread that sometimes a harbor can be better to use to connect. Of course, that assumes that they are coastal. I've never used a harbor to connect cities to the capital unless they need that because they're on another landmass. I suppose I could see some situations where perhaps that would be the case, except that if you actually completed the road network, you know, depending upon where they are, the fact that you then have that benefit of the faster road movement probably would negate most of the time building a harbor instead of a road.
Now, later in the game, railroads require a direct connection. You can't go through a harbor.
Yeah, that too. my favorite suggestion, in a way, is from Alex K., where he talks about, have your workers develop each tile within one turn of completion. So then you can, with enough workers, then you can go boom, 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 like in a single...
Right, so you don't have the monetary penalty.
Until you connect...
While you're building the road, yeah.
I maybe earlier on in the game, that might actually get yourself ahead.
It's definitely, yeah, it's about the early game.
So many workers.
So many workers. Build the pyramids for those two. the free two.
That's what you do with them, I guess.
And the three, you need to chop out the pyramids. There you go.
There, yeah.
You almost buy it. You can almost do it.
Oh, God.
Insta road between cities. Go, go, go.
You could even have a single worker just do, you know, two out of three turns on that road for each tile, and then just go in one turn per tile, complete the rest of the road.
Yeah.
I guess it would take two, because he'd have to move and then complete the road. But if he's on a road, then he wouldn't have to move unless he moves into a rough tile.
Yeah.
But that'd be a little quicker than normal. I'm not sure that the benefit is really that significant.
No. And I also think about someone doing that in multiplayer. Oh, yes. Like, why is your turn taking so long?
I think that kind of micro used to matter a lot more back when you were running three city grids with road connections to all the tight lattices and all that. You know, when you start to talk about, you know, literally hundreds and hundreds of roads in an empire, it starts to add up.
Yeah.
From episode 129.
We had a poster, Rodriguez, who wanted to look at some of the differences between using cottages versus going with a specialist economy and building farms. This is one of the long-time classic trade-offs in Civilization IV between running a cottage economy and running a specialist economy. I have a number of different things I could say on that, but I will open this up to let other people on the panel want to talk on this. So I don't know if one of you guys has particular thoughts on this.
Okay. Yeah, I definitely do. I've been all over this thread in strategy discussion. Basically, this guy's question is when he should be building the cottages versus farms at the individual city level. And the answer to that is it's a little bit complicated because you have to look at traits, where you are in the game, what you're trying to do with the city, and go from there. And also, you know, what other roles your other cities are doing, because sometimes you need a city for great people points, or you need a city for production, or you need a city for commerce, and you just don't have a good fit. So you pick something for that goal in mind. So the basic conclusion throughout the majority of this thread is that cottages in a bureaucracy capital, as long as the capital is remotely decent for a bureaucracy, they're good. They're strong to have the 50% pre-multiplier. So you have a multiplicative stacking. It just makes it really strong. So bureaucracy cottages tend to be good. Other than that, you might consider a couple more, maybe one other cottage city in the early game if you have riverside tiles to work. And otherwise, you're going to be leaning on specialists very heavily in the early game. And that's for two reasons. One is that it takes your happy cap limited in the early game. And in order to clear the happy cap issues, unless you have a ton of resources or you just conquered your continent, in which case you would cottage everything, you're going to be cap limited. And the specialists are going to offer more returns sooner at a limited happy cap. Whereas if you have lots of happiness, you can throw cottages everywhere. And also the great person points. The bulbs in this game, they're not Civ 5 bulbs, which are ridiculous, as we've pointed out earlier in the show. But bulbs are still pretty strong. And especially in a game with tech trades on, you're talking about, you know, you'll get a base 1,000-plus beakers, and then, you know, probably that again and then some through trades and selling techs for gold, if you're talking about a single-player game. But even multiplayer, there's some good things you can pick up in bulbs, especially astronomy. And
So you're looking at not only the raw yield of the specialist, but the great person points. And that does have diminishing returns in direct GPP as well as just, only so many cities can farm them. But for the most part, the scientist is probably better than a non-riverside, non-financial grassland cottage. Now, financial changes this equation a lot, because now instead of like a 70-turn payback, it's happening much faster. So when you're financial, you have more incentive to cottage more cities. Sometimes you still want to farm some great people because the returns are excellent, and you still need production. So you don't want to cottage absolutely everything, unless that's one of your silly variants. That is, but you're going to cottage more with financial than you will with other traits, and certainly cottaging takes less micromanagement too. So this debate has always been around. Actually, the forum culture as of these days on strategy and tips, they don't really talk about CE versus SE any longer, because people have really gotten to the point where they're considering how they're applying each city in their empire and what their goals are. And I think that's been a good change in the landscape, to be honest. But yeah, this does definitely go back to the old CE versus SE debate. And one of my favorite things to say when somebody brings up the SE is that the space elevator is terrible and you should never build it and be on this floor. I don't like acknowledging the specialist economy versus cottage economy, especially when so frequently a bulk of your input, your outputs are coming from something like your hammers, you're building wealth and research, or you're getting a mix of things, or the vast majority of your research is coming from trade routes either way. It gets to the point where it's silly. You have a fixed number of possibilities that you're gaining your technology from, and in any given game, there's probably at least something coming from the majority of those. So whatever. But yeah, non-riverside, non-grassland cottages are a little weak, especially when you're cap limited. So I would only do that if, say, you're playing on Marathon or something, and you immortal rush your entire continent, and you're trying for space race. That's very common in the Hall of Fame. Okay, then fine. Cottage everything, especially because you're probably Darius. But for more standard games, high difficulty, I wouldn't lean on cottages too much in those types of situations, because it takes you too long to get to the important text. And, once you get the important text faster, you research faster, it's better to learn to use specialists to some degree. I guess that's what I'm trying to get at.
From episode 90...
I would like to talk about how the top five cities determine. When I see top five cities, a lot of times it seems to be based on wonders.
Big cities lead to wonders, wonders lead to culture, and culture leads to the dark side.
Okay.
According to Ergi in the thread, in looking at the code in the civinfoscreen.py file, the way it's formulated, population is technically the biggest factor. Food, production, and gold matter, beakers, espionage, and current culture rate do not.
I don't remember.
The value for a city in the ranking appears to be population times, and then in brackets, 1/5 of the total culture points, plus food per turn, plus hammers per turn, plus gold per turn.
So approximately population times culture.
There you go.
Wow, it actually means less than I thought it did.
I never paid that much close attention to the top five cities.
Well, once they were all mine, I just stopped looking.
Well, I constantly see them because I'm always going into that screen to see which wonders have been built.
Yes.
And it usually is one of the capital cities, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, you just look at the top five cities, and it's like, ooh, there's one of my future cities, and there's another one of my future cities, and another.
Yeah, exactly.
From episode 97.
The rough go in bringing Civ 4 to Mac. Believe me, I know what it's like, because I was an Amiga owner, and I listened to the QQP representative tell me that they didn't develop for Amiga anymore because there were too many platforms to support, when there were really only like two at the time, but there were like 400,000 different PC configurations out there that they happily supported. So yes, I know what it's like to be ignored by those big developers. So at some point, you've got to just say, I'm not going to worry about it anymore. I'm just not going to buy their product. Or I'm just going to stop using this Mac. Or whatever it is you got to do to get past it, stop crying, do something useful.
What's our context?
The context is, because the Mac represents such a small percentage of the computer market out there, A lot of developers don't develop stuff for the Mac at the same time they're developing for the PC. It's the 80-20 rule in action. 80% of your income comes from 20% of your customers. Well, those Mac people, they're not in that top 20%, so it doesn't make sense to cater to them.
I see. So their numbers are still too small, and they're still not the more avid gamers, so they lose out. Well, that's their own fault then. If the demand were there, they would do it.
Right. If the Mac community represented 50% of computer game sales, and they weren't getting the respect, okay, yeah, you're absolutely right to whine and cry to high heaven.
Well, then it wouldn't be on the people anymore. Like, if it's 50% of the market and one company isn't covering it, somebody's going to, and the company not doing it is screwing up to the degree where they're probably going to pay for that.
Absolutely. And before you get to that point, though, where you have that kind of market power underneath you, I'm just going to call the whambulance for you. You know?
If you play, like, a shooter online and kill people with something they think is cheap, then you'll hear a real whambulance.
From episode 99.
One thing I do remember, though, if an AI decides to declare war on you, you could actually watch it march a stack all the way down from one end of the world to the other. As soon as it got to your borders, if you made a defense pact with everyone else, it was smart enough to update and decide to not attack you.
Yeah, that doesn't happen in Civ 4.
In Civ 4, once it makes up its mind, it almost never corrects itself. It'll be too scared to attack Zera, but it will attack you even though you just made a defense pact with Zera.
Yeah, that's pretty bad.
I think the series went a bit backwards on the AI there.
They won't even mind basic power changes. Like, it starts plotting war for 30 turns, and in those 30 turns, you drafted, say, 50 rifles, and it's got a stack of 30 units of no better than knights. It'll still declare. Sometimes it'll even declare if somebody declares war on it. It'll still declare on you.
Yeah, Monty does that a lot.
That's not always guaranteed, though. Sometimes it actually will break war plans on you if someone else declares on it. I'm not sure what dictates whether or not it quits on that. And I've also seen it instantly declare on you for refusing a demand, despite the fact that it's at war currently.
Yeah, Monty does that all the time.
Yeah, he does, and I know Julius Caesar does it. I think there's a couple others, too.
The main reason I get war declared on me by Monty lately is because he'll be at war with someone, he demands something from me, and out of habit, I'm just like, no, because he's at war. Well, he can't declare on me, and
yeah.
2 turns later, he will.
If you're careful with diplomacy and you bribe him into wars with people, this is something else that shouldn't work. The AI should not be able to not plot war against people who they have a peace treaty with. Because that causes it to do all kinds of stupid stuff. Like, it will march across the world to declare on somebody rather than prepare for the next war against someone they just fought just because they rolled a war during their 10-turn peace treaty. So they'll completely expose themselves to the opponent they were just fighting just because the random number generator said so, and they can't handle it. So if you have Montezuma at pleased and you, like, ask him nicely for a gold, one gold every 20 or 30 turns, you can literally have the chances of him declaring on you.
I love that trick.
Yeah, it's a good trick to use, but I'm not so sure the AI should be so limited that that kind of thing works.
I usually wait until he's just about to cross my border before I do the one gold trick.
Oh, yeah, because then you can even see exactly what city they're targeting and what they're going to run straight towards. Yeah. That's always good. Or if they're doing it intercontinentally, and they land all their troops on your shores, and then when they declare it, expels them back to their continent, and they don't have, like, the AI boat-loading logic to actually handle that, so they never really actually attack you. It's good times.
It's not something they thought out very well.
No, not at all.
From episode 110.
Discovering El Dorado in 3925 BC.
Yes, we're getting into some of our grab bag here of intro outro topics. El Dorado, oh my, and of course also the five culture you can get from working that tile if you settle a city that can make use
it's
of that.
It's shiny.
Oh my.
These things have no place in the game. They do not have any place in the game.
I'm fine with the five culture. I'm okay with the five culture, but the 500 gold, especially at that point of the game, my word.
Just an advantage to give to somebody just at random. It's too much.
Okay, I'll take a couple of workers, or I'll take a settler and a worker through a rush by, and
yeah, I mean 500 gold is good at almost any era of the game. So if you get it like right at the beginning, it's amazing. I've never gotten this bonus. Have you guys?
I've only seen El Dorado a couple of times so far because it's on the natural wonders list. I usually see other things like Krakatoa and the Great Barrier Reef, things like that.
I don't see a lot, but I'm happy for that. I think it's no place in the game.
Imagine is asking, is it only Spain that gets the gold? That would make some historical sense. The person who started this... Well, I don't know. The person who started this thread, TM Moot, said he founded Paris, so he was playing as France, and he ended up getting the 500 gold. I didn't think it was any Civ specific, but there certainly is the 5 culture.
I like the comment that Bueller680 did. If this was a multiplayer game, after you buy a settler, you could put a quick, I'm opposed some news with Skill Dorado in the chat box. Good measure.
So well said.
I think, yeah.
We know that all the good players plan on finding El Dorado in 3925 BC.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a winning strategy. It is a winning strategy.
There's nothing but skill in that, in finding it that early. And if you are good, you will find El Dorado by, you know, before 3900 BC. If you don't, well, you just need to practice more and learn to play. L2P, there you go.
Yeah, until you discover El Dorado in 4000 BC, I think you need to keep trying.
Yeah. For sure.
Yeah, what would you guys do if you guys got that bonus? I think the consensus in Thread was to pick number one, which was Cash Buys the Ruler as soon as Paris reaches a pop of 2.
Yeah, and you can cash buy the worker before that, so you can start improving the tiles that much sooner.
Yeah, and Civ isn't... power builds exponentially in Civ, so 500 gold in the beginning is worth way more than 500 gold later on, because it's going to build on itself, and you're getting ahead of your opponent.
Good old-fashioned turn advantage.
Another thing you could do is even if... I've noticed about half the time I've seen El Dorado... where it actually is located is very impractical to be building a city, at least early on. So if you're thinking, oh, I'm going to miss out on that 5 culture, I mean, the third option that TM Moot pointed out was, you know, cash gift to a city-state for food or culture, assuming that they're both of which, you know, are nearby because you've found them already. And, yeah, you could actually hopefully find a culture city-state and... Use that money. I mean, man, with 500, you probably already have a little bit of extra gold by then as well, either just through income or getting rid of some barbarian camps or meeting those city states, whether you're the first or the last. You could get one of those guys to ally it right away,
which just compounds your advantage.
Yes,
because having a food bonus for the entire game. I mean,
coupled with tradition, yes. From like turn 4, yeah.
Yes, or yes, or for a maritime, yeah, because you can get food for your capital as well as your other cities. More for your capital, but still, any food is an advantage. So,
I think we all agree that the Skill Dorado opening is a good one.
Yeah.
Yes, that's its new name.
El Dorado.
Yep.
And even an unskilled El Dorado opening would probably be good too. I mean, ways that you can use that 500 gold that would be like not advantageous to you.
Well, the important part is just to have enough skill to get El Dorado.
Yeah.
Surely.
Yeah, it's all awesome. Yeah, I was reading a little bit of the thread, and people were saying, some wonders, such as Krakatoa, are just built or occur in areas that are not really conducive to city building. And I was just wondering if that was just on purpose because of, you know, just, you know, if you... discover you already have the bonus, and you know you're not always going to be able to work the tile if it's just not in a great place. And they were mentioning that El Dorado is not really in a great place either. So I don't know. I would like to see a little screenshot and have them do a save or something so I can play it too. But yeah,
I would like to know if it's actually coded that way because I doubt it, honestly.
Part as well is supposed to be coded, like, you know, so it's in the middle of nowhere, like on the island.
Maybe. Maybe there's a bias of some kind. That would be good. Skill Dorado, though.
Yeah, large bonuses handed out at random in the beginning have a very destabilizing effect on the game. Because, well, yeah. Well, no, actually only skillful players get it.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, why did you pop El Dorado?
You see, that's really the only disadvantage to El Dorado is when someone else gets it and you don't. But, you know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that would really suck.
That's when we start hating it, right? Really.
But, you know, only the more skillful player would get it, so that's a moot point.
We're all playing in the same game, and there is El Dorado in the game. Therefore, we all have an equal chance to do it. And if you chose not to take El Dorado when you had the chance, I'm sorry. That was just god and awful.
Exactly. We're eating the link to troll all now, just so you know.
Jeez. Polycast. Messing up your ability to think critically one moment at a time.
It kind of reminds me of the old protective kind of cheating strategy from Civilization IV, where people would get stone, and then they would build walls, and then kind of whip it, and then get the overflow in gold, and then they would end up with, like, 1,000 gold at the beginning of the game, which was not really... I mean, at least they did
it. Wait a minute. That's not comfortable at all, because...
because you get a lot of gold early in the game.
That is skill.
Yeah, but you still get a lot of gold early in the game. I mean, that's
well, okay,
point.
That much is comparable, but you don't get a lot of gold early in the game. That's random. You have to, well, you can...
There's a cost.
You can do that regardless with Protective. That was one of the appeals of the Protective. One of the few appeals of the Protective trait. Was to be able to do that.
Sorry, it's got a little bit of a... Lisa mentioned the Protective, just a little bit of a migraine coming on here.
I'm
especially for the AI to have listeners. Oh. I love the trait so much.
Time spent playing. How do you end a session? And of course, this thread has a poll in it, which is, by the way, to get chosen as a topic on Polycast, that's a +25% modifier. I bet you didn't know that. Thread started by Cliff9710. How do you end your Civ sessions? Currently leading is Biological. When I get too tired or hungry to continue. I don't think that's an exclusive list for Biological. Social, when my significant other, parent, or kid bugs me to stop. Psychological, when I feel guilty about the time I've spent. What?
What? There's 17 people that actually said that? What?
Look, just because you can put choices on a list doesn't mean you just put a choice on a list for choice's sake. Come on.
Yeah, because, I mean, sometimes people misclick on those, and then you get skewed results.
Mechanical, by alarm clock. After X hours, minutes, I stop.
Oh, I didn't know people actually did that.
Yeah, you just set it to like 17 hours and then you kind of fall asleep to the alarm.
Oh, I just set it for 2015.
Only when 6-6 comes out, yeah.
Logical, when I have achieved a goal in the game, or numerical, when a certain number of turns or game years have passed. I'll bet you if you chose numerical, I bet you like the time victory, huh? Yeah, I bet you like that you go for it in the game. Yeah, it's good for you? All right, then. And then other, 21 people voted other. That's almost 20%. Other.
Well, because really, you can't pin it down to one thing. It's usually a combination of more than one of those things.
The reality is that they simply didn't stop, but didn't have a good option for that, so they picked other.
I'm still playing. I've never stopped.
Mine's usually a combination of logical and biological. It's like, I have a certain goal, but can I stay awake long enough to make that? Let's find out.
Yeah, mine functions pretty much logical, exclusively.
Yeah, Phil doesn't need much sleep, apparently.
I get enough sleep. I just play my games quickly enough, but that's usually what ends first.
From episode 110.
Let me summarize how Rob ended up not only writing this article, appearing on this podcast, but started playing Civilization, and that was because of peer pressure. Isn't that right?
Yeah, pretty much. It was peer pressure and persistence.
Sounds right.
Because I think you were defending Civilization as a preferred or the preferred game or franchise with some of your fellow gaming journalists, as I recall, more recently, which kind of led to this article in part.
Yeah, GamePro is running a series on sort of games they regard as niche titles. Now, we can question whether Civilization is truly niche, but I guess in the broader gaming world, it is.
Which, it is now. I mean, in the olden days, Civilization.
I know, when gaming was good, yeah.
Yeah.
Nostalgia!
So Kat Bailey got in touch with me, and she's just written an article on the Pokemon series, why she's fascinated by that. And the next one was going to be about Civilization, and they tapped me to write it. So it's a really basic question. Like, I mean, why are so many of us so dedicated to this series? What are we seeing that other people who've tried to get into it or have seen the screenshots and it just doesn't grab them, what are we seeing that they don't? And so I was just sort of given license to write whatever about that topic. Like, how did I get into it, and why have I stuck with it? And so, I mean, yeah, for me, the story goes back to I was a complete, action gamer. I mean, it was all Doom and Dark Forces and war games. But I just Civilization, it's, a game about, it just sounded so incredibly boring to me. I mean, who cares about Civilization? Civilization is all around us. I want games about panzers.
Too real, right?
Yeah, but my friend kind of dragged me kicking and screaming into the first Civilization, and it's just such a well-constructed game that, for the first 5 minutes, I was like, I don't get this. Why am I even bothering playing? And then 10 minutes later, he's like, so do you want to do something else? I'm like, burn in hell! That's how we started spending all our time together after that was, all right, let's run another game.
And then what am I doing this many years later? I'm still playing it. Now I'm also talking about it. What?
And also doing that for many years. So now maybe just briefly, how each one of us, the starting path, the first step towards appearing on this episode, appearing on this show in the here and now. I actually, I'll start. Rob's talked about this. I was playing SimCity, and I know back when Sim games were good and meaningful. And I went there.
Yeah. I'm there with you. I'm waiting for you. I was waiting. You came wrong. It's good. We agree.
Good, good.
Yeah.
I'm sure I'll get hate mail from somebody. But anyway, delete. And
ooh, mail.
It was blank SimCity. I really enjoyed that. And there was this present in front of me. It was Christmas. And it was, your grandparents bought this game for you on our recommendation because we know how much you like SimCity. And I opened it, and it was the original Civilization. But this is, Civilization, the original Civilization came out in 91.
Mm.
This was Christmas present 93 or 94, so the game had already been out. Mm. Because I remember, and I still have the box, there was a sticker on it, a seal about, how many units had been sold, like 600,000 sold or whatever. And I looked at the box, and in the moment, I just kind of gave this sheepish grin like, oh, gee, thanks, Civilization. I kind of... similar to Robo, it's just like, oh, if I want the real world, I'm already living that. Like, why would I want to do this?
Sucks.
Well, I'll install this, and the game will be over in a short amount of time, and I'll go back to playing SimCity.
Hmm.
Well, it's a good thing I'm not a betting man, because I could have lost everything and then some. Oh my gosh. Just as an extension of that, played Civilization, and before interwebs... when Civilization 2 came out, I was actually several hundred kilometers from home. Mm-hmm. I was in a store looking for a Mother's Day present, and it was a really weird store because the store had a little bit of everything, so nothing like a store where you could buy furniture and computer games. It's like,
oh, a precursor of Walmart?
Yes, without the greeters.
Yep. I don't know. There was something about those old games, and they were able to kind of hold our attention for years and years.
They didn't have to rely on shiny graphics to keep everybody's interest. If the gameplay sucked, you weren't going to play it.
Yeah. I've gone back, like, when I go to my parents' place and I'm stuck there and I got nothing to do occasionally, right? Because they live in the middle of the country, in the middle of nowhere. I don't bring my big, heavy, my stationary computer with me, but I bring a laptop, and the laptop doesn't have a good screen card because, it's sucky, but I can play Panzergen on it. I can play
Civ 2 or Civ 1 on it, and occasionally I do, and it's awesome. It's still great. Occasionally, you know, when I play the Civ series, especially Civ 2, I feel like, oh I want to play Civ 4 because it has kind of more depth to it, but it's still pretty awesome.
To say the truth, I haven't started by the Civilization series. Back in, whatever, 97, 98, when I got to college for my first degree, a friend of mine introduced me to Alpha Centauri.
So what you're saying is you ended up graduating a year later?
Basically.
Exactly. That's a bad time to be introduced to the Civ series.
To any form of it. Just one more turn.
Well, I still play Alpha Centauri a lot, but then I've got to, when C3 got out, I said, oh, this name on top of the box looks familiar, but let me try it. To be honest, I've got a little disappointed with C3 when I started it. First of all, the terrain is completely different from Alpha Centauri, and I really like the Alpha Centauri terrain and the deformable and whatever. Mm-hmm. But I started to like it. I started to play. I started to like it, and some more hours wasted in playing. Which was a little bit later, but thank God I was already not in college.
Well, I had one of the guys I worked with, because I used to work in a movie theater in high school, but he also played some games, and we had a few games that we had in common. We'd actually swapped discs, even though you weren't supposed to do that. But he kept telling me about some game called Civilization, and no, you should try that. I think you'd like it. And he was persistent with me about it, and finally did go and get it, and then I actually started playing it, and the infamous thing where the next thing you know, it's the next morning, and oh crap, I have to get up for school. Oh crap.
Get up.
For episode 124.
If your citizens could write books about you. not for the original few, you know, posts in there, because they were kind of boring and useless. But when Mulatto Maker popped in and actually wrote his post.
Oh, wow.
That was awesome.
And there's a couple others that had longer, fun stories.
Yeah.
I appreciate the creativity of it. Yeah. So what would your citizens say, Maki?
Well, they love me because I give them so many happy things. But, oh, don't cross her, man, because did you hear what happened to Arabia? Yeah, exactly. There isn't one anymore. And hear about the warm reception she gave to the other Civ? Yeah, they're going to be warm for the rest of their life, which isn't long. Love me and fear me.
I think mine would just be, like, just as long as Mulatto's, but every single thing other than the intro would just be their nuke symbols or troll faces the entire way through.
Yes. It's Phil's solution to everything. Tactical nukes.
Hey, I've only fired off like 300 in some games. I forget what my record is, but I have gotten to 300 legitimately built tactical nukes in a game before and fired them.
Versus the illegitimate nukes?
Well, the world builder and... Because people can world builder in hundreds of nukes or whatever, but I built every single one of those nukes.
Wow.
No, but it does look like Mulatto Maker did put some effort into it, and that was pretty good, and it's funny.
And let's see, on the second page where you have XRW numbers mixed with letters, and he talks about one of his first city founders. That's interesting and really depressing, actually. And then Old Skald gives an interesting rendition of his sailor that discovers that the world is round. But I think it's an interesting idea to put reactions or like reality in with some of the things that we're doing in our games. It adds an interesting dimension to it. But I'm weird.
A lot of makers like, he had to stand still in one place for 700 years.
Yeah.
From episode 125.
A trick in Civilization 4. And no, this is not dirty. Go ahead.
This is a family show.
Geez. I'm introducing a topic that's not dirty. I don't understand. Okay. Anyway, this threat is by 6K Man. Not sure if anyone noticed this trick, but normally when one of your units wins a combat, that gives it an experience to be promoted. The promotion can't happen until the next turn, right?
Yes, and so basically what he is saying is that if you have enough experience and you are waiting on a promotion this turn, you can fight a battle and get to the point where you could take a second promotion and then take both promotions on the turn you attack. His example is the most common one. You have a unit that can take a promotion and is at 4 or 3 or 4 experience. You attack with it. Now it has 5 experience and you can take 2 promotions. I could have sworn I mentioned this trick on the show at one point, but yeah, that is something you can do. And if you are charismatic, especially, then you only need 1 combat of any kind coming out of a barracks. So it's very worth considering in, say, a rifle cannon war or really any war involving collateral to just attack with your unit first and then take your promotion, maybe going instant city garrison 2 for when you dump the unit into the city. So you attack into the city and take city garrison 2, stuff like that. And it is a useful trick because it will marginally increase your fighting effectiveness in Civilization 4 if you use it intelligently. Obviously, you don't want to be attacking at really low odds or lower odds and lose the unit outright. That's not helpful. But as long as you don't go too aggressive with the usage of it, it can help your odds a little bit in war. And yeah, he's asking if it's a bug or feature. I have no idea. I don't think Firaxis knows. So, but it's there. I don't think we're going to see another Civ 4 patch. So let's just call it a feature and have done.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at The Polycast or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net. City Ruins and You. Before I ever read the thread, I saw the subject title. I had this vision in my head of an infomercial from the 1950s. Like, hi, Bob! There's Bob! He has city ruins! But does he know he has city ruins? Would you recognize city ruins if you saw them? What's that there, Bob? Point and wave! I'm just thinking, like, anyway.
That's Dan, I do not know what to make of you citing things from the 50s.
The 50s are an unacceptable time period from which to quote.
I don't know. It's just, he's old.
What?
Unacceptable?
Unacceptable.
We don't accept old people here in Polycast. It's for young people only.
That's right. You're over the age of 16. You're obsolete, obviously. And I don't mean the forum poster. As long as you don't dress like you're from the 80s and have that somehow show up on the show, I think we're all good.
Record dates assorted 2010 and 2011.
You got to wonder what some of those units are thinking, though. I've been sitting here for 1,000 years. The borders have already expanded past my outpost. Why can't I go home?
Civilization 4, 5, and World Sound Clips. Copyright Take-Two Interactive.
Just pick one day and send, like, 500. It'd be good times. Good times.
500.
That twirl would be brown colored, but it probably would still taste good.
Okay, stop right there.
This is a family-friendly show still, so...
No, if you mix all the colors together, you'll tend to get this blackish brown color. That's just how it goes.
No, it's a melting pot. I don't know why we're assigning colors to emails, by the way. Are you, like, reading auras or something?
Oh, no, it's just because we had the initial swirl going on with the 2 flavors from the email this time. But as you add more and more flavors and colors, then you get strange mixings, and you can no longer predict the outcome.
Wow, did I just come up with an older reference than Phil knows? I mean, isn't that from... Because the 2 tastes is from the commercial, and they definitely do not swirl the peanut butter and the chocolate together, man. They keep them wholly separate, even though they taste so good together.
Hey, be that as it may, you do not necessarily have to take that as a thing.
I can do the conclusion, and I can use my amazing announcer voice.
Wow. And you only start using that now. Great job. Okay, go ahead.
So, what do I say?
A great announcer voice now needs a script.
You need a teleprompter, David. Where's the teleprompter? It's chaos without the teleprompter.
I will read anything on the teleprompter.
Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.
And the broadcast has now come to an end.
Oh. All right.